Welcome to our second anniversary episode for Revolver Reads, a book club Russian roulette.
Woo!
Woo!
We're a podcast where we let the wheel of doom enlighten us or bring our minds further into the depths of hell. Or neither, who knows, because we don't. Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? He's gone, Juliet, and he's not coming back. Not while you're breathing, anyway. Are you prepared for the juiciest breakup of 2006? And no, we're not talking about Britney Spears and Kevin Federline's divorce. But also, screw Kevin Federline, and we hope Britney is living the dream. We are taking you all on a trip through the darkest timeline. A timeline where Edward leaves poor Bella Swan alone and vulnerable while monsters draw nearer. In a book titled After a Spiritual Period of Reflection and Self-Awareness, it becomes increasingly clear that these star-crossed lovers wouldn't recognize either of those words if it hit them on the head. In Stephenie Meyer's sophomore novel in the Twilight series, New Moon, we are forced to come to terms that despite hundreds of years of living on planet Earth, Edward has the emotional intelligence of a potato. That's fine, though. We all love a good spud. So please, grab your rain gear, a snack, and something or someone good to drink, and join us down in Forks, Washington. You're probably going to need it. For Bella Swan, there is one thing more important than life itself, Edward Cullen. But being in love with a vampire is even more dangerous than Bella could ever have imagined. Edward has already rescued Bella from the clutches of one evil vampire, but now, as their daring relationship threatens all that is near and dear to them, they realize their troubles may be just beginning. Bella and Edward face a devastating separation. The mysterious appearance of dangerous wolves roaming the forest in Forks, a terrifying threat of revenge from a female vampire, and a deliciously sinister encounter with Italy's reigning royal family of vampires, the Volturi. Passionate, riveting, and full of surprising twists and turns, this vampire love saga is well on its way to literary immortality. In New Moon, we had front row seats to watch the scraps of Bella's self-esteem completely disappear. Edward left no crumbs. We begin this tale with 17 going on 80-year-old Bella Swan arriving at an unwanted birthday party with the Cullens, and it ends with her forearm filled with shards of glass. Thanks, Jasper. We can say the obvious lesson is to never trust a Confederate soldier with battle scars.
Scars.
Battle scars.
So good.
Devastated, emotionally, and completely ignoring his barely legal girlfriend's opinion about her own trauma, Edward thinks the best idea is to leave Forks and ultimately Bella for good. He does this by leaving his lovesick and danger-prone girlfriend alone in the woods, like she wouldn't try to chase after him. Oh yeah, in the same woods where a hostile vampire and a pack of werewolves patrolled. In Edward's absence, Bella falls into a deep depression that Charlie has no idea how to cope with, other than suggesting the single most intelligent thing in the entire series, therapy. She doesn't go, of course, because she's literally insane, and that's why we love her. Bella continues on her internal monologue of self-flagellation until she starts to spend more and more time with Jacob Black, thus completing the infamous love triangle that will haunt the rest of the series until he falls in love with. This is a welcome distraction until Bella finally decides to fling herself off of a cliff and call it cliff diving. She would have drowned herself if it weren't for Jacob Black. But this kind of kicks off the dramatic twist that lands Bella in Italy, running straight towards Edward in broad daylight. Other characters of note are Sam Yuli, the alpha werewolf, and his fellow pack members Embry, Paul, Jared, and Jacob Black. Our vampire friend from the first novel, Victoria and Laurent, also make a guest appearance. Lastly and least were Bella's friends from high school, Jessica and Mike. As a warning to new and returning listeners, this is most definitely not a spoiler-free zone. Also, please take a look at our trigger list found in our episode description before you continue. We would also like to make an announcement. In the creation of this series, Stephenie Meyer appropriated the existence and stories of the Quileute tribe without their knowledge or consent. No profits were shared with them, and throughout her series, Stephenie enforces harmful stereotypes of the Quileute tribe and indigenous people generally. Currently, the Quileute tribe is raising funds in an effort to relocate their community to higher ground as climate change threatens their community's location with rising ocean levels and tsunamis. As of August 2023, they finally relocated their tribal school and are now working on relocating other critical facilities to higher ground. We will include a link to their fundraiser in our episode description, and we highly encourage you to donate whatever you can, if you can. Otherwise, please share this link with your friends if you are unable to make any monetary donations. My name is Vanessa.
My name is Nav.
And I'm Rebecca.
Welcome to Revolver Reads.
So, what did everyone think of Bella's deep dish depression?
It's the mental illness in it,
though. Honestly, to give Stephenie Meyer one thing, she knew that the girlies wanted an Italian summer before the girlies knew they wanted an Italian summer. Who doesn't want to be running at a hot man?
It's cold.
Oh, you know what? Physically. Actually, you know what?
You don't know
probably
that.
Didn't look all that great.
Excuse me.
You know what?
Do we want to... Hold on.
He's literally supposed to be the most attractive man at school.
She describes him as a marble tribute to the forgotten pagan god of beauty.
She's also fucking insane.
Yeah.
No, he's supposed to be attractive. All the vampires are supposed to be, so we can assume
that. I mean, Emmett sounds attractive. I don't know. Edward... maybe it's just the movie clouding me as well right now because it's so fresh, but he looked like someone that really tried with their makeup. It just wasn't successful. Like, it was just bad.
If you're going to start insulting Robert Pattinson, we're going to have to cancel podcast now.
Robert Pattinson is gorgeous. What they did to him, whatever the makeup department did to him, it was bad. Like, it was objectively worse than any of the other siblings or Cullens.
Are you kidding me? Alice's wig? Awful.
Well, of course, but that was never going to get better.
Either way, though. Okay, let's move away from the movie. Okay, just for a hot second. Iconic. Great. So let's just think about the books for right now. So we're thinking about, you know,
romanticizing Romeo and Juliet. Ooh.
I mean, it is a romance play, but the complete and utter lack of self-esteem Bella has is kind of literally fucking insane. It's extreme. It's a lot. I don't remember it being that bad as a teenager. Like, for some reason, my brain wasn't fully formed at the time and thought, you know what? This is bad, but like not that bad. And when I'm reading it as an adult, I'm like, this girl is 18 and she literally thinks she's nothing because her vampire boyfriend broke up with her.
Yeah, like that was extreme. She collapses in the forest and just can't move from there until Sam Yuli comes to save her. And I'm like, it's not that, it feels more like an obsession than love at that point.
I can understand the beginning part. I can understand her like being in shock. Like, it was a complete 180. He was like all lovey-dovey that a bad accident happened at a party that compromised her life, even though we fully did not just have to thrust her into the wall. There could have been other ways other than slamming her into more glass, but you know what? It's fine. Shit happens. I can understand in that immediate moment because it was just such a shock. And she's like, she's never been in a relationship before. So this, plus all of her like other self-esteem issues and thinking about Renee, she clearly has some sort of abandonment issues. It was the thoughts of who she was as a person. Repetitively, she literally thought that she was a fixer-upper at 18 years old after her first breakup. A fixer-upper. She thought she was broken after her first breakup. She thought that she was basically worthless. It just speaks to how much she does not have any sort of self-esteem for herself. It's really devastating and really sad to see, as like I'm now 30 almost basically, and how worthless this 18-year-old thought she was because this vampire broke up with her, completely left her in the middle of, not in the middle of the woods, but in the woods. Like, it's kind of crazy to me how devastating
how
that was.
We also accepted that this was just a thing that is okay to happen. Like, Bella is, the parentification goes so fucking deep. I think there's actually a line. I think it's Charlie that says it. And he talks about how he took care of how she took care of Renee emotionally for like years. And I'm like, wow, like, you get it. At least someone gets it. And I'm like, how the fuck do I not remember this? Like, why do I just think that she was maybe just a responsible as fuck teenager? It is depressing.
And I feel like her self-esteem issues start even before Edward leaves her, because I feel like if we want to even go back to the very beginning of her birthday and the fact that she doesn't want attention from anyone on her birthday, no kind of attention whatsoever. I did not remember this originally. On page 13, she writes about how she keeps a tally of all the things that Edward has done for her, and she feels like she can't accept gifts or nice gestures without needing to give something in return. It's not okay. It very much feeds into that idea where she doesn't think that she's good enough. And I think that's when he says that he wants to leave, she doesn't question it because she already feels like she's not his equal. Like, the whole reason that she wants to be, or part of the reason she wants to be a vampire in the first place, is to be more of his equal.
She has to be a convenience to everyone around her. Like, even she subconsciously does this with Charlie, where she's making all the meals for him. Charlie's lived on his own for years. I don't think he protests it because Bella is also very fucking stubborn. It's very clear that, yes, the self-esteem happened before. And I think we spoke about that even in our first anniversary episode with Renee and the way that she was a parentified child. And it's very, the birthday party thing was such a red flag. The fact that she wanted no one to even say happy birthday. I can understand to a degree if you're a bit more anxious and you don't want like a big celebration, but the mere fact that people are saying happy birthday to you is very extreme, especially for, in my head, she's a child. I know she's turning 18, but like that doesn't just cross over immediately. Sure, you're no longer a minor legally, but she's still really a child at this point. And it's just kind of crazy because it's like, this is something you're supposed to be celebrating. You're turning 18. Like this is usually like the big day for a lot of teenagers. And it's just, I understand Edward being younger than her, quote unquote, physically is like one thing, but this was extreme, very extreme.
Yeah, she views aging as like a detriment to her, like another way in which they will become unequal, which I feel like kind of plays into society's thoughts that like women aren't allowed to age. Like at one point, Alice says, and I was like in my head because we are closing in on 30, Alice says, don't women usually wait until they're 29 to get upset over a birthday?
Yeah, it just speaks to how much she was neglected as a child and she had to be a convenience to her mother or else she would not get the attention she required as a child. Does that make sense to anyone?
Yes. Yeah, it makes complete sense. Because even when she detects something is wrong, she understands that something is going wrong, especially when after her birthday party, after the attack, Edward starts acting really cold. And she starts having like these nightmares. She realizes that Edward has parked in her father's parking spot. That automatically builds this like sense of anxiety that like he isn't going to stay. This feeling that she's had in the pit of her stomach, something bad's going to happen. And she thinks so little of herself that she asks herself, what is the worst that I can live through? Not even how can I be happy? The bar is literally on the floor. It's what can I survive?
It's 6 feet under.
I feel like that doesn't stop either. I feel like that continues throughout the entirety of the book, even with her conversations with Jacob, because if she had more self-esteem and she didn't think herself as like unworthy and a fixer-upper from the onset of the novel, she definitely, I think, would have been more receptive to a relationship with Jacob, because her whole thing is like, I'm only made for Edward. And if I'm not made for him because he rejected me in this devastating way, I'm not made for anyone. And even though she's definitely, okay, I know like the whole entire thing of Rose, she's mentally saying like, I don't want to be with him, which is totally fine because she's not emotionally ready for it, but she is still enjoying his presence. And I think she loves him in a certain kind of way. And I feel like if she had not had her brain messed up in the way it was, she would have at least tried a relationship with Jacob just a little bit more than we already had. And I feel like she can't live a normal life either because of all these self-esteem issues, which kind of leads her back to Edward like he's the one and only for her. It's just weird. It's a weird dynamic in this novel specifically, because like in the previous novel, it's about what she wanted. And now it just feels like what she thinks she deserves.
Well, she's basically running after scraps of attention. Like, I don't think I understood just how bad that abandonment issue was until Jacob starts to pull away after he gets, the transformation essentially kicks in after the movies, and she is like calling, leaving messages, trying to get some scrap of attention. And it's just like, wow, she's scared of being not alone, but not enough or worthy of like even an explanation of why the people that she seems to love around her don't want her in their life anymore. Like, what is she lacking? What is she not doing? And like, I felt bad for Bella in this book a lot.
I feel like I didn't even mind her being more needy of Jacob and his presence. I felt like at least we got some sort of fight out of her. Something's wrong. I want Jacob in my life. It was more along the same tones that we had in Twilight. Like, this is what I want. And I'm going to make sure that I continue this, at least this friendship with him, because he makes me happy. He's the only thing making me happy right now. But yeah, it could be the abandonment issues. But we're also like, in the beginning, it was like this weird cult thing that Jacob definitely had a problem with. And it is weird she called him so many times. But at the same time, at least we got some sort of like fire.
Action.
Yeah, we got some fire in her. Like she's been in this like depressive stasis mode because of Edward. So I felt like at least she was fighting for something, fighting for herself even just a little bit.
Yeah, the codependency is definitely real, because she basically goes from being codependent on Edward to becoming codependent to Jacob, which I don't necessarily disagree with for her character, just because, like, I get it. She showed up in this new town, and the only people who ever really paid attention to her were people who did it because they were looking to get something out of her. Like, look at her friendships with Jessica. Look at her relationship with Mike. Ultimately, they were using her, and the only people who actually paid attention to her as who she was as a person was basically Edward and Jacob. Like, Jacob has that line. This was the one, Rebecca, you and I were talking about in the group chat.
But she thinks, like, he can read her mind. He's like, no, I just pay attention to you.
Yeah.
Crumbs.
While we're talking about Jacob, do we want to back up just ever so slightly to talk about the iconic scene that is, I think, iconic in both the book as well as the movie, which is the idea of the time passing by just being represented by blank pages with just the months. I thought, and I've always thought, that it was such, like, a fantastic representation of this, like, zombie state that we hear Charlie describe to Alice later in the novel. Like, despite the novel being in first person, she is so completely overwrought by Edward leaving her that she can't even recall those first few months. And even the chapter afterwards is called, like, Waking Up. Like, she's, like, shooken from this daze.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. And I mean, Charlie talks about it later as well. The only times, and I think he's talking to Alice about it as well, when the only time she really shows any fire or there's any life to her is when they're trying to force her to leave Forks. I remember seeing that and I was like, wow, okay, same. But, like, I agree. I don't think I've seen it, at least in the books that I've seen or read, not seen, a way to show just how much depression, or I would call it depression, not even heartbreak, in this situation, that it completely blanks out blocks of time for you. Like, she's done nothing. She's gone through the motions she needs to be able to exist there. And just, like reading it at the time, like, I remember reading New Moon. I was just like, wow, this is, like, blocks of time that no one remembers. Like, it was just sad at the time, and it was sad again getting to read it, because if you look at the ages of these kids, they're, what, 16, 17, 18? And for her to have, like, what was it, 4 months of her life that she just is basically a dead body walking around, depressing to read. And, like, for once, Stephanie Meyer did something right.
Yeah, it'd be her senior year, right? She's turned 18. So she lost months out of the time. And I think the general dialogue around it, like, that is usually really, it's fantastic, because it's right. Especially if you're, not only is it just her in a depressive state. I mean, I spoke to Fedra about this in terms of the dialogue. We ended up watching the movies together for Halloween for some weird reason. And I was like, this is the scene. This perfectly describes how, like, depression feels like in terms of, like, the zombie, like you said, Vanessa, behavior, attitude, like, mindset. And it's not only just the depression. She is PTSD. She's waking up screaming. We can't unexpect that, because she literally went through a physically traumatizing event where she had a vampire, like, breaking her legs and sucking her blood, and then her waking up in a hospital. There was a lot of things that the Collins sort of left in their wake that weren't okay for Bella. And she just sort of accepted it as, since this is what I want, it's okay for these things to happen. Or not okay, it's normal, it's whatever. And it's unfortunate that these things resolve themselves when Edward reappears, because those nightmares would seem normal with or without his presence, because she went through a terrifying experience. And then even after, again, skipping ahead a bit, the Volturi, she was perfectly fine with that event as long as Edward was around. And it's just, it's
sad to see her safety net be a man.
I don't get how she's processing these things, or she just stops processing these things for the fact that it feels very connected to the fact that she doesn't want to be emotionally inconvenient. You know what I mean? She needs to stomach everything so that way she can be convenient to those that she loves the most. Like, Edward sleeps with her, so why would she be screaming in her sleep? You know what I mean? It's just like, I feel like there's something unconscious about that even in the writing. I know she's not a real person, but I feel as if it's not unconnected.
No, I agree completely.
And even, I guess, just to circle back to, like, the point where we have in the novel with the depression episode where it's just sort of blank pages on a page. Even when she wakes up, she's not fully connected to those around her. It's almost a struggle, and she disconnects completely pretty much, or she endangers herself until she sort of meets Jacob. And then there's a limited endangerment where it's at least supervised to a degree. But I'm just thinking about what she did with Jessica. Even when she's here, she's not really here. She's still just constantly thinking about Edward.
Yeah, that shit was wild. Going up to random men at a bar. Crazy.
She acknowledges that it's crazy, too. She's like, I'm okay with it. As long as I get to, like, still hear his voice. Like, I'm okay with being crazy. That's fine. And I think that makes some of the other scenes where she puts herself into danger so heartbreaking. Like, I always had a really hard time reading the scenes where she does jump off the cliff. And basically, she thinks that she's just going to do it as like cliff diving. This is going to be fun. And then when she hits the water, she realizes this is not at all the fun that she kind of thought it was going to be. And she goes on this entire monologue about happiness and how she was happy that it was almost over. And then when she like sees him in the water, she's like, I was content. I'd forgotten what real happiness felt like. It made the whole dying thing pretty bearable. And it's just like completely devastating that this is kind of like what she's living for at this point. And I know that that scene is a trigger for like a larger epiphany for her in what I like to consider like the third part of this book. But it is kind of, again, devastating that it takes a near-death experience for her to reach this kind of like epiphany type of moment.
Yeah, and it's an escalation. I feel as dangerous and controversial as it is in terms of like riding a bike, a motorcycle, I felt at least that was closer to some normal teenager shit. You know what I mean? Like screwing around with your friend and riding a motorbike behind your dad's back. That felt, as much as she was still vying for Edward in her mind, at least it felt a little bit more normal to me. Not normal, but teenager. Like dangerous teenager things. It was still within that realm, but her cliff diving and then going, oh, this is the closest thing I'm going to feel to happiness as I'm drifting off to die. This got real dark. You know what I mean? It got really dark. She's like, at least I got to see Edward again. And it's just, was this, you should not be peaking in this moment. This should not be the peak of your life right now, but this is what it is.
The one, I guess, benefit that comes out of that moment, we are kind of fast forwarding, and I feel like at some point we definitely need to go back. But I feel like that moment allows Bella to come to terms with the fact that she can live without Edward. She doesn't really need him to survive. And it's ironic because then at the start of the novel, she had asked herself what she could survive, and she assumed she couldn't survive without him. But this near-death experience, the death of Harry Clearwater having a heart attack, it makes her realize that she can live without Edward. And she goes into that larger Romeo and Juliet metaphor where she is, Bella is obviously Juliet and Romeo is Edward and Jacob is Paris. And she basically asks herself, like, what if Paris was your best friend and the one you could confide in? What if he understood how you were feeling? And what if you loved Paris, but it wasn't like Romeo, but it was could be enough? And I feel like definitely in that moment, it reminded me of that scene in Eclipse where they're in the tent and Jacob says to Edward that if he had stayed away a little bit longer, he could have made Bella happy. And I feel like that, I guess, like revelation that she really didn't need him anymore, that she could give up these hallucinations.
And I still think Charlie's amazing idea of therapy was probably the best idea. And I think with some of that,
sprinkle some therapy in.
Sprinkle some therapy. Maybe she wouldn't end up with Jacob, but she could at least explore a relationship outside of the first and only relationship she had romantically.
No Mike, though. Please, God, no Mike.
No Mike. Oh my God. Oh my God. That reminds me now in the beginning where they're driving after Jasper attacked her for having a paper cut. He was like, if you were with Mike, it would be normal. And this is after all of the melodrama of the events that followed where Edward's freaking out. Jasper tried to
Kool-Aid jug for Jasper.
Yeah, basically. And she was like, I would rather die than be with Mike. He's like, don't be melodramatic. I'm like, sir, have you looked in the mirror today? Because you are king melodrama. How dare you? I would rather be dead than be with Mike too. Hello? Hello?
He literally is so dramatic because when they're watching Romeo and Juliet, he's like, I envy Romeo, his easy suicide. That's also
how is
like
this normal.
Correct. I also think, and it makes it really sad because at the beginning of the book, Bella describes that summer as like the best of her life. But I feel like Edward was very obviously thinking differently following her attack in Twilight. He was clearly contemplating leaving for a while and thought that that was the only way to keep her safe and protect her quote-unquote innocence and all that kind of crap. And I feel like Jasper is more like the tipping point, because even the fact that he makes that comment about Romeo and Juliet makes me feel like...
Yeah, that was also a very melodramatic comment, and she just sort of accepted it as it is. And he's like, don't be melodramatic about saying you want to die over dating Mike. And it's like, you literally wanted to die because I was going to die, sir. Yes, he was contemplating it. Though, major plot hole, Alice said she's either going to die or become one of them. So he chose the death option. He chose the death option, not even knowing what the death might be. And Victoria is just chill, just lingering around. And same thing with Laurent, and the same thing with every other vampire in town that wandered across her. So I'm like, I'm very confused. You know, Forks, Washington is like going to be the spot because it has mostly rainy days. So what is happening? What is happening in the House of Comets? Like, what was the logic? Really?
There was none.
Correct. Correct.
Agreed. He's completely delusional in this one. Completely.
Yeah, I don't
for
even
like 90% of it.
And honestly, yeah. Alice, when again we're skipping like a little bit ahead, is when she jumps off that cliff and Edward thinks that she's dead. Thanks, Rosalie. Thanks a fucking lot, Rosalie. Just spreading the news. He thinks she's actually dead, and Alice and Bella are escaping on a plane. Again, skipping ahead like to the very end of the book, and they're on their way to Italy. Alice is like, I don't get this. I would just turn you myself at this point because this is getting goddamn ridiculous. I'm like, thank you, Alice. Thank you. What the fuck? It doesn't make sense. You literally have someone who's told you lottery numbers and how the stock exchange is going to go, but you're just going to be really chill and think things are going to change for Bella. Delusional.
Completely. And I feel like the entire novel, kind of going off of what you were saying, is centered around miscommunication. And I know that's definitely a theme in Romeo and Juliet. I remember being in high school and someone said if they just had an iPhone, things would have been a lot different.
Don't kill me.
Yeah. In that's grade 10, phenomenal. Romeo and Juliet, someone said.
I remember who it was. I'm just going to leave it at that.
And I feel like it's the same here. We have so many instances of miscommunication.
But how,
like,
are they handled, though, by different people? Hmm?
Exactly. They're all handled differently. Edward's communication skills has decided to completely erase themselves.
Fuck off. And fuck off and die.
Yeah, he doesn't understand how to communicate anymore. And then Bella completely misunderstands him as well. Like, there's literally a part where he's like, Bella, I don't want you to come with me. And she turns it into, you don't want me. Like, it's a complete...
Well, then he tries to make it really convincing that he does not want her there, to be fair. And he's like, how easy it was for you to believe it. I'm so confused. I'm like, you're literally dating an 18-year-old with a scrap of self-esteem.
And then you
blew it away like a leaf in your hand, just gone. Like, that was it. It's gone, guys. It's gone. And yes, and I'm Team Jacob in terms of miscommunications, because he handled all of them fairly well for a new werewolf. Because every time there was a miscommunication in terms of how Bella felt about the Cullens or Jacob or anyone else, he realized he was the one that messed up and went, oh, my bad. I thought you meant this when you really meant that. I'm really sorry for hurting your feelings, Bella. I kept a promise. I'm going to keep it. And then they would move on. And then another thing would happen. But at least, you know, there was something other than I'm going to fuck off or not listen to you and what you want. Or please marry me, Bella. Please, please. Even though you fully say no.
Yeah, what the fuck? I completely forgot that he proposes technically at the end of this book.
I did not forget. That does not surprise me whatsoever, because this is Romeo and Juliet. There has to be a wedding.
I hated it.
But to go back for a moment to Jacob, because I was a certified Jacob hater in high school. And
honestly,
come
Eclipse, it will be the same.
Yes, we'll go back. But Jacob here was so pleasant and so wholesome. He's such a happy person. Like, what a little ray of sunshine. He is so patient and so kind. And I feel like the film does him a real injustice.
I'm screaming, crying, sobbing, throwing
up.
It
was awful.
It was not fair to him. And honestly, a little bit fucking racist, because they turned all the wolves into meatheads that are angry all the time. Yes, he had like moments where he boiled over, but it wasn't the extreme and the cruelty it almost was in the novels.
In the movies,
it was almost cruel to Bella, where it almost like pigeonholed Edward to be the one and only choice. And there wasn't like a room for Jacob. But in the books, I feel like he was, like, it's so unfortunate. It is so unfortunate what happens to him. Even him becoming a werewolf is unfortunate, because had it not been for the Cullens and their irresponsibility regarding Victoria and Laurent, he would have never become a werewolf at all.
Yep. So what you're saying is Jacob is mental healing and Edward is a representation of, like, mental deterioration.
I don't know about that.
I would not go that far.
It feels like it.
But it's just like he expressed more maturity as a human being, as a 16-year-old werewolf, than Edward did as a 110-year-old vampire at certain points in this novel.
Agreed. And, like, a spot that sticks out particularly to me is that scene where they have that very awkward triple date at the movie theater by mistake.
Best.
Half of their friends get sick, so they go and watch this horror movie with, or Bella goes to watch this horror movie with Jacob and Mike. And in the book, when Mike gets sick, Jacob gets him, like, a popcorn bowl, and he drives him home. Like, he makes sure that he's okay. In the movie, Jacob all of a sudden is like, "You want me to put you in the hospital?" I was like, what is happening?
Yo, what the fuck was
aggressive
that?
For no reason. And even his, like, anger and hatred towards the vampires, it just felt different. It was a different quality. It hit different. It was different in the novels. Like,
the reason that fucking pissed me off as well from book to movie was, in the book you get an explanation of why his change was so late, was because he was so happy. So everything kept boiling on, which is why that aggression makes no fucking sense. The entire reasoning that they sort of give behind him transitioning or turning so late is because he is so happy with Bella. So what the fuck happened in the movies?
They made him into a real jerk.
They did. And they completely over-sexualized him too, because even reading the scene where they're on the motorcycles and Bella falls off, he removes his shirt and hands it to her to kind of, like, dry the blood. And in the book, it is not in any way, shape, or form like a sexual scene. She mentions that he's beautiful, like, when he's driving her to the hospital afterwards. And I think it's because we're getting it from Bella's point of view. And at that time, she's not necessarily looking at him sexually. Like, she loves him as a friend. At one point, she says that she could potentially love him as a brother. But in the movie, it was very much for, like, fanfare. Like, he stripped off that shirt slowly. And I remember being in the theater and everyone was screaming. Like, it was a completely different vibe.
Correct. Nothing about him looked like a 16-year-old. Like, that entire scene was sexualized.
I mean, there are some, let's say, under the radar sexual jokes that do happen, but it's usually playful and it's usually towards Bella and she doesn't realize it, but it wasn't like that. And again, I feel like that plays very much into the racism that is very, it's already apparent in Stephanie Meyer's novels, but it's enhanced in the movies. And that corresponds with, like, how men of color, it's usually Black people, but also I don't think Indigenous people are too far off from the stereotype of being, like, hypersexual. They're hypersexual towards white women specifically. And I don't think that did not fall into that trope. And it was not a good time, like, thinking about it at all.
Especially that shirtless conversation in the rain. I was like, I don't remember this in the book. No.
They were in a garage out of the rain having a heated conversation. And not heated in that way, in the sense that he thinks that, like, she doesn't like him because he's a werewolf and she might have been friends with the vampire that they just killed. It was a bunch of miscommunications. It wasn't, like you said, we're getting it from the perspective of Bella, which I felt should have been the heart of the movies, which it technically was for some periods, but just not towards, obviously, the men of color. You know what I mean? Or the hypothetical men of color. I'm not even sure if Taylor Lautner is...
He's not Indigenous, no.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, the marketing of the film very much focused on the Team Edward, Team Jacob, and I 100% don't feel like this is what this book is about. I feel like the book was very much kind of about Bella and her right to choose and about discovering who she is and what she wants and what she's going to do to get it. And, like, the movie very much did not paint it as that.
No, I feel like the movie and the book are completely different entities.
But speaking of parallels, did anyone catch the parallel? So in that scene where Jacob and Bella are talking about Jacob becoming a werewolf and we have that miscommunication, Jacob goes, "I'm not a killer, Bella." And it made me think back to Edward and Twilight going, "I am a killer, Bella." I found there were a lot of, like, parallels like that throughout the book.
Even the way they handled Victoria, I mean, there was a vampire threat and both the vampire clan and the werewolf clan handled things very, very differently. To the point of, I think I mentioned this before, but the point of consent. I feel when James was hunting Bella, it was very much Edward's way or the highway. And he was like high emotion, screaming or being very aggressive, at least. And Bella had to somehow calm him down and convince everyone that her idea was the best idea. Meanwhile, you have Sam and the rest of them. A, they're all very calm. I mean, as calm as they can be. And B, they ask for her consent for her involvement in terms of like her being in La Push and being involved with werewolves at all. It was just a very different vibe. It was a very different vibe completely. Like in terms of the parallels between the vampires and the werewolves. Vampire hunting was very different.
I think they sort of, I don't know if they like fully acknowledge it in the book, but it kind of felt like it was an answer to that. Whereas, you know, when they're talking about the Cullens and the Denali clan, they talk about how odd it is that they tend to live in a group environment like that, whereas usually they're very solitary creatures. So I can sort of see why it would be a lot more tension trying to get to some sort of a decision, or it's like a my way or a highway type of thing with the way that Edward was. Where's the pack? Like, to me, it made sense that everything flowed a bit better. There was one clear alpha that they're following.
For now.
Essentially, the idea is that they follow their orders. They work in the way that they're, I guess, quote unquote, assigned to work. That I wasn't like, I guess I wasn't too surprised, but I didn't really pay attention to it. It just makes sense to me that the approach of the wolves would work a lot better because they don't think the way that vampires do. Those are solitary creatures. They're going to know how to hunt each other, but they're also going to know how to hide from each other, especially because Victoria does know about Alice's visions. But like, it made sense to me, I guess.
Agreed. And I think all these choices are strategic because even the chapter where she is asked if she would like to be part of this, that chapter, I believe, is called Family. And I feel like it's very much setting up, I'm going back to it, the Romeo and Juliet of the Montagues and like the Capulets, the two warring families. And Bella would be part of one family and then Edward's a part of the other.
Yeah. And it gets really weird in the books. And even when Alice comes back, that dynamic is really weird because
he full on ices her out, doesn't he?
No, I mean that, but I meant even the way that Alice and Jacob act towards each other. I can understand Jacob to a degree because he's 16. He's a new werewolf. His mind is full of the thoughts of all the other werewolves that have been taught these stories about vampires. You know what I mean? Like it's going to be more biased and not really understanding of the way that the Cullens live. But like, Carlisle is the only one who's kind of normal towards the werewolves for a long time. Even Alice is weird towards them. It's like, you don't even know them and you're acting like they're your ultimate enemy as compared to the vampires that virtually want to use you for your powers. I understand to a degree that they're made to be enemies, but the Cullens are sort of also meant to be different from the other vampires. So it was a very confusing dynamic with Alice specifically. I understand Edward being a little bit of a bitch towards Jacob. Got that loud and clear. But Alice, who's sort of an outsider to this particular argument, I don't know. Weird.
I thought for the vampires that hadn't had to deal with the wolves, it was weird, especially because they're made. There is nothing in their DNA that, DNA quote unquote, I'll say, in comparison to this book, that ingrains it in them that there is an enemy that they need to be wary of. The werewolves, I can understand the way that Stephanie writes it is, you know, it's in their, I don't want to say DNA, but through evolution, I would say the pack has known to be wary of vampires. Those are their natural born enemies.
The even. Only reason they exist at
exactly.
all.
Exactly. Whereas for the vampires, I like, why? I don't think there should be that aversion. It doesn't make sense to me. Now that you said it, I wouldn't have even paid attention to that actually from the books. But yeah, why? Like, Alice is from the South. She's made after a specific age. She hasn't known about werewolves before that. There's no reason for her to know about them.
They kind of do. They do know because, well, they like, made the pact.
The
but
treaty,
it's,
yeah.
Yeah, but it's not as if she's been running from werewolves her whole life. So it's just
exactly.
weird.
Agreed. Like, I feel like there should have been a little bit distrust and distaste just because, again, naturally, they're just supposed to be repelled by each other's very scent. So that I would understand. But the level of distrust, I agree, was way too high considering this guy has just been protecting someone you consider your sister.
Literally. The only reason she's maybe fucking alive.
Not even. Literally, completely the only reason she's alive, because if Jacob had not pulled her out of that water, she either would have drowned to death or Victoria would have grabbed her.
Yeah, and she was in the water. She was the flame or whatever. The movies made her a lot more close than she was supposed to be, I feel. I remember that, with like her swimming in it. And I was like, okay, that's a little, okay, fine, whatever. I agree with the point that there might be an aversion. Let's say the emotional aversion that Alice had, where it was like the physical aversion, sure, I can understand, like, ew, you smell disgusting. I don't know about this, because they are sometimes, especially if you think about Paul, a little bit unstable in terms of their emotions. And that can have an end result with, for example, Sam and Emily, where Emily has scars because Sam like transformed before her eyes and messed her up, to say the least. Like, it created like lifelong scars for her. But it's not like Edward hasn't created lifelong scars for her physically, because James... So they literally talk about how, I think, remember Jacob pointed out that her scar was colder than the rest of her skin? I don't know. It was really weird, that dynamic, for sure. But I guess it was, again, to do the whole Romeo and Juliet thing, which I feel like was so heavy-handed for me. It was mentioned at least
everywhere,
every chapter, or every other chapter, let's say. And it was a lot. I don't remember it being that heavy-handed before, but it feels heavy-handed now, I guess, as a more learned reader.
The time it came out, I mean, we were covering Romeo and Juliet in school, so it just feel like most of us probably romanticized the idea of it.
Oh, 100%. When I was, so I still have my copy, which is like 15 years old at this point. Let's age us all. There are literal marks on my book when Edward leaves Bella. I must have been crying. Vanessa. So I feel like that, I agreed. I feel like that must have been the focus, was on this, like, this tragic love story. And that's probably why I was so anti-Jacob even now, or not even now, even when at this point in the novel, because in my head I was like, he's Paris, he's not good enough, and she deserves the best, which wasn't fair. Although I do have a question, because I saw some reviews online, and a lot of people made the comment that Bella was a bit of a bitch in this one by saying that she was leading Jacob on. How does everyone feel about that comment?
Listen, this is 500 Days of Summer all over again, where she clearly states exactly what she's looking for and how she feels at every step of the way. And Jacob is 100% okay in consenting to that. Maybe what he wants at the end is different, but he's never going a step without her. Like, he just holds her hand. He asks if that's okay, and she says yes. They're 18 and like 16, 17. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to be a little bit weird. It's not going to be the best relationship. And there might be more blurred lines in terms of friendship versus romantic relationships, what they want at the time. Fuck all those fucking reviewers. She did not lead him on. I'm very fucking confused. He was willingly there every step of the way. What
they,
if you wanted
to read the same book?
No, I mean, there might have been teenagers as well. Or again, it's just she was very clear with how she wanted the relationship, and he very clearly consented to that kind of relationship. They said at least they wanted to be friends, and maybe if they were a little bit more than that, that's something that they both knew willingly that they were gonna have to lead into gently. Like, Bella just started talking, like processing her emotions about Edward with Jacob closer to the end, before she flung herself off a cliff and sent this off in a totally different trajectory. So I don't think she led him on at all. I think Jacob was there for her the entire time. I'm just very confused about how anything that she did led him on.
I agree completely. There were so many of those reviews with saying that she was such a horrible person, and that like her actions didn't match her words. And I was like, I feel like we're reading two different books, or that you have different understandings of how friendships operate, because I do feel like this book is ultimately a story about different types of love as well. Like, we have that romantic love with Edward at the beginning, and like
it's
the heartbreak
more than romantic.
That stems for that. Okay,
it's
yes.
Obsessive.
The obsessive, I guess, like with Romeo and Juliet, they're trying to describe it as like fated love, like they're meant to be together type of thing. But then when you also have like the friendship love that comes along with Jacob, you have the familial love from her dad, who like actually pays attention to her, as well as the rest of the Cullens, really, who kind of love her for who she is, minus Rosalie. But
I have a bone to pick with that. I know she has this thing in Eclipse too. I'm skipping way ahead out of this book in particular, but she like mentions colors of love and how Edward was like this faded relationship and how it's a deeper color of red or a deeper color of love, whatever the hell she wants to call it. I have such a bone to pick with that entire theory, because he's talking as if love is some static thing. You know what I mean? Love isn't static. It changes day to day based off of the decisions that you or the other person makes. It's a commitment. There's so many things other than fate that are a factor to a relationship. It can enhance itself. It can detract itself at any point in time, depending on what one contributes to that. So that's why I don't understand the theoretical argument that eventually is made that where faded love is somehow the end goal. Like, that doesn't exist. And this is why this is a fantasy novel. But at the same degree, it's just like, I don't know. I have a whole bone to pick with that whole entire thing that she creates between Edward, Jacob, and Bella. I would have rather been an inconvenient but pleasant mess where we have this love triangle and it is what it is, rather than trying to put their love in some kind of boxes as if it's some static thing that could be contained to those boxes at all. I'm not talking about the ending of Breaking Dawn either, how they solve Jacob's issue.
Contained to her.
Yeah, like that's what I mean. It's just like, it's just so weird the way that she captures love and tries to define it that way. It's just, it's really weird to me, but.
Agreed, because I feel like she's locked herself, as we're using the metaphor of the box, into this box of Romeo and Juliet. And that's what they were. They were fated lovers. There was no room for any kind of real ambiguity. And so because she's locked herself into these classical novel references, she loses that potential for nuance. Because I think even Eclipse is supposed to be Wuthering Heights, right? So it's just like she loses that potential for making like a deeper or more profound message about like what love really is or like what it's capable of.
It does not help with the racism part in terms of comparing it to Wuthering Heights either in Eclipse.
No. Correct.
No, like what? Hello?
We'll get there next year. I did enjoy the puns, though, because before we find out Jacob's a wolf, Bella says that she's dog tired.
Yes. I didn't even catch those.
Also, I think at one point in the novel, Jacob says, "I bet you taste good."
Stop.
I think I can't.
So good.
Yeah. There was a lot of like things that were happening and I was like, okay. Also, I guess in a sort of semi-related note in terms of like weird things that were described and references, I guess vampires smell like Excel gum to vampires, icy and sweet. And I was like, what is that gum? What else is icy and sweet other than like toothpaste and mint flavors?
Can't with the explanations and descriptions.
Like a dog is easy to conceptualize, but what's icy and sweet? Please, that is
mint
overly...
Mint chocolate chip.
How is that bad though?
Oh, I hate mint chocolate.
Excuse
me? I have no explanation. I don't simply like it. I'm sorry. You might as well like stick XL into a tub of like chocolate ice cream and chew that.
It's yeah. Same. Gum is delicious. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
I don't know. For me, those are two flavors I do not like combined.
But yeah, some of the descriptions were really intense. Like, I guess like circling back to one you, Rebecca, alluded to earlier, where she compares herself to like a vacant house. She's like, "I'm an empty shell, a vacant house, condemned for months, utterly uninhabitable. Now I was a little improved. The front room was a little better, but that was all just one small piece. And Jacob deserved better than that, better than one room, a falling down fixer upper, where no amount of investment on his part could put her back in working order."
Disgusting. I'm sorry. I feel so bad for Jacob in that regard. Like, her disservice to herself is almost inhibiting the relationship she could have with other people, whether it be romantic with Jacob or with even her own like father in terms of like connecting with people around her. Sorry, continue.
No, agree completely, because I was going to connect it to the fact that she thinks that she's fooling Charlie. And when Alice shows up and Charlie's talking to Alice, it becomes very clear that Bella wasn't really fooling anyone, because when Alice asks, like, how is she doing? Charlie was basically like, it wasn't like someone had left her, but it was like someone had died. And Bella overhearing it was like, "I had died because I lost my truest of true loves. And if that were not enough to kill anyone, But I understand the next part where she was like, it was hard enough. She came to this town. She didn't feel like she related to anybody. And then the one person she finally related to was a vampire. And she fell head over heels in love with him. And she thought this was it. This was going to be her future. And not only did she lose him, she lost his entire family. She basically lost a whole future that she had chosen for herself. So, of course, it would be like, not only him leaving, but like a part of her dying. Like her, she was basically saying goodbye to a whole future that she had planned out for herself.
She didn't even get a chance to say goodbye. He hits her with that clean break shit. Doesn't even let her say goodbye to her best friend.
Yep.
You can say vampires don't make good friends, but they made better friends than Jessica and Mike and Lauren, for example. She does like Angela, but she's tied to these other like really horrible people around her, even her own boyfriend. So I feel for her in those moments where this, like, some of it is just teenage angst and some of it is mental illness. But yeah, like, he does, like, that final clean break annoys the hell out of me. He even takes the CDs. How insane is this? After a breakup, at least you have some sort of remains to mourn over. He took everything. I mean, he hid them underneath the floorboards. We knew that. But, like, she didn't know that. He hid her CDs that he burned for her. Pictures, everything. That's crazy. That's not okay. That doesn't let someone move on.
It would be like I never existed.
Fuck off, Edward. Like, that's not how the human psyche works. Hello?
He doesn't know that because he's been stunted as a 17-year-old.
He has the emotional depth of like peeling paint.
But the thing is, he's had 110 years to develop his emotional intelligence, and here we are, stunted.
You would think. But I feel like he probably spent most of that 110 years either by himself or with the Cullens. Like, I feel like they don't really interact with anyone else.
Yeah, but
so
the
he
Cullens,
doesn't really realize
Carlisle?
How normal. Carlisle, I feel like, is the most normal one.
Esme
he's also the
spends time a lot of time around people as a doctor.
Esme and Carlisle are perfect. Alice has more emotional intelligence than him. Isn't she younger?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't remember.
As a vampire, not maybe as like a physical human being, but like it almost seemed intentionally cruel for him. It almost seemed, even though it was beneficial, quote unquote, for her, it felt like more of an emotional unburdening or losing responsibility almost for Edward. Like an unburdening in terms of responsibility for him. I know it was like he didn't like it. He didn't want it to be happening, but it wasn't like anyone asked for it other than himself. There's some sort of, I don't know, religiosity to him that was beckoning for that answer.
Maybe. It also just makes me like, I know some of us haven't read Midnight Sun, so it also just makes me think of like how his character is portrayed there. And if we think that Bella is depressing and self-deprecating, Edward takes it like to a whole new level. So I feel like, I don't know, like there's something, he also needs therapy. Like
that's
deeply.
What I mean, like you've had 110 years and for what?
To all be just as money. Lost as he was at 17.
Yeah, worse maybe.
A good therapist.
I think he's worse than he was at 17 because he went through that whole phase. He's like, he's a vigilante killer where he's like, I only kill the bad guys, but I killed people, Bella. I killed them dead. Like, it was just like, that's where he's stuck emotionally is after him being a new vampire rather than him being a 17-year-old. He's stuck in that phase about how he damned himself. I don't know. It's weird. I think he does need to seek therapy, but it's just, it's weird. This book does not do that relationship
any favors.
No, none.
No, it really doesn't.
I don't know. I just reading it. I was trying to figure out how in the hell I ever thought that this was something that I was rooting for.
Same, because even if you want to talk about the way that we first read it, I feel like I probably read Twilight, New Moon, and Eclipse probably like 5 times. I did not read Breaking Dawn more than once for reasons we will explain when we read Breaking Dawn. But the breakup was just like, as Vanessa's tears on her page alluded to, emotional. And then there was the depressive period with Jacob where there's some kind of at least a friendly dynamic happening and a supportive dynamic happening. And then, finally, Alice comes back, right? You're like, the relief. You're like, finally, we get the vampires back. There has to be more to this novel than just the fucking werewolves, right? And then you get the reunion part. It was like euphoric in a way. They're like, finally, they're back together. Oh my God, at last. And now I'm looking at that like interpretation and going, what the fuck? How was I ever happy with this situation?
Just reading Edward as a character, I'm like, how was I ever at any point team him or team anyone? He's unbearable. He's actually unbearable to read.
Thoughts, Vanessa? Them's be fighting words.
Them's be fighting words. I do disagree. Even today, I probably do still disagree. I do think that this is probably my least favorite portrayal of him, maybe outside of, again, Breaking Dawn. But I do still think that there is a little bit of a redeeming arc towards, I guess, like kind of like the third part of the book. I kind of defined the book into three parts, like before he leaves, then Jacob, and then when Alice comes back. Because I guess like you do kind of get an explanation of what he was thinking. Does it make sense? No, but at least there's some kind of explanation. And in my head, it was always like, at the end of the day, what matters is what Bella wants. And even if it doesn't make sense, even if, like we said in the last Twilight episode, like the significant thing is that she gets to choose and she chooses him, even if it's not necessarily the right choice. So the act of like choosing him, I feel like, is what usually lands me back in Team Edward territory. But if we want to rewind for a moment and talk about one of the most interesting parts of this novel, the introduction to the Volturi, how does everyone feel about them?
Badass as usual.
Of course. I mean, having watched the movie recently as well, Arrow just seems a lot more attractive as a character now.
He seems, okay, if we're talking about the comparison between the movie and the novels, the books make him seem a lot more disgusting than he's actually portrayed in the movies.
In the movies, yeah.
Yeah, he's supposed to have like papery skin. He's supposed to be so old that he's almost like a decrepit version of a vampire, if that can possibly exist, if that makes sense. It reminds me of, what's that vampire's name from What We Do in the Shadows?
The Baron?
Yes, the Baron. Exactly, the Baron. It's giving me Baron energy.
Agree completely. I even picked up on the fact that in the book, Jane is described as having pale brown hair, and she's very blonde.
In the movies? Yes.
Yeah.
They're badass. I wish we got more of them than we actually do over the whole series. They might have been more interesting to read about.
Yeah, they're definitely interesting. Like, if we had a book about the whole court system, I feel like that would be something to read for sure. Because they've been around for like 3,000 years.
I feel like there were more vampires in the Volturi scene as well, because I forgot that there was
the whole guard.
They have like not even just the guard, they have a court. They have a court of vampires that are just chilling underground with them before they even enter the room with like Arrow, Caius, and Marcus. And all of them, they have a separate room of other vampires and other, let's say, aristocratic vampires.
Yeah, I was wondering if they were more like the witnesses that show up in Breaking Dawn.
Maybe. I thought they were,
it was just like holding court. Like they were the Volturi court, not...
Maybe.
Not court because, as in trial, but court as in aristocratic, as like, court. Like you entertain a group of people.
Exactly.
Less witness, more let them eat cake.
And they do eat cake because Heidi brings in all those humans. So technically...
Yes. Yes, they do. I forgot about the old woman that Bella cries over.
Yes.
The rosary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like she has control of the situation while she's in there, but when they're out there in like the lobby waiting for the sun to rise, she just has like a full panic attack. Rightfully so.
And Alice is just like, should we slap her? And I'm like, fuck. I mean,
it's an idea.
That's her asylum experience speaking.
To smack her out of the panic attack that she's having, because that will help. As she's having a full-blown like mental breakdown. She's like, oh, I realized the chattering sound was me. I'm sobbing and having like a full mental breakdown. I don't know. Alice seemed a lot more practical than she does definitely in the movies as well. She gives very much manic pixie dream girl energy in the novel, that at least New Moon, that was not the vibe. She was all business.
Yeah, very much. I'm tired of this crap. We're coming back home and I'll do it myself.
I mean, Bella tries to hold her to it, but...
That was funny, though.
She does. She was like, bite me here on the plane. And Alice was like,
do it right now.
It's not going to work like that, my friend.
You're going to be writhing in pain. I don't think anyone wants that for you.
I guess, like, speaking of, when they come back, we get that whole scene with Bella and Edward where they're basically, like, he's explaining the whole situation to her. And she decides that enough is enough. They're going to bring it to a vote.
Because the Volturi say that she has to turn into a vampire. And then Edward gets the final verdict and then starts fucking screaming and flipping out like a goddamn teenager. Unacceptable.
Agreed. I completely thought that that was, I did think that was kind of out of character because he doesn't really flip out on her at any other point. I was like, since when does he scream no in her face? Like, that's not something he had ever done before. It was definitely a weird scene. I definitely also did not remember that when I was rereading.
Me neither. That about the vote, I do not recollect that at all. Literally blacked out. I think they met and my brain was like, that's it. They're back together. We're all happy. Moving on. But yeah, him screaming no into her face and like flipping out.
He has like a temper tantrum because he loses the vote ultimately. So Bella basically says, I don't really care what you say. At this point, I'm part of a larger family, so I'm going to go ask that family what they think. And they take it to like a family vote. And basically everyone votes yes, except for Rosalie and Edward. And Edward loses it because Bella turns to Alice and says, okay, are you ready right now? Let's go.
And she's like, I don't know if I can. She was like, no, the opposite. She was like, I don't know if I can do this for you because you taste.
No, Bella.
Oh, yeah. Bella.
Like, bet. Alice, bet.
She's like, I'm ready to go without any kind of thinking about anyone else. And then afterwards, she's like, oh, yeah, Charlie. His best friend just died. Maybe I should take a chill pill.
But also her and Charlie at the end where he's like, you're not allowed to see Edward anymore, which he's not really wrong about in terms of at least getting a little bit less codependency on him. And then she's like, okay, that's fine. He's like, what do you mean fine? I'm like, I'll move out. He's like, fine. Fine. Yeah.
He cannot win, pretty
much. No, no. It's really unfortunate. Poor Charlie. He doesn't win even when they get married and she disappears from... Spoilers. Anyways.
So, yeah. Her sickness.
Anyways, besides the point, Charlie never wins. He always gets like the shittiest end of the stick.
He does. And I feel like he's even willing to like to get that shitty end of the stick. He's kind of like the MVP sometimes in my books, because at one point he's like, I think you need some help. Like, I just want you to be not even happy, like not miserable. And then he's like, I think it would do better if you got out of Forks. And this is like earlier in the novel, right? Mm-hmm. When she kind of wakes up. And I was thinking about that scene to myself and I'm like, Charlie's been alone this whole time and his daughter finally comes to live with him. And let's be real, he loves it that she's there. Like, it means the world to him that his daughter is there. And he's such a good dad that he would be willing to let her go, to let her leave, to live somewhere else if it meant that she would have some kind of semblance of happiness. And it's just devastating. I mean, ultimately, I'm glad that he ends up, I mean, again, spoiler alert, being able to be part of their lives like long term, because he's honestly like one of the best characters in the whole series.
He really is. Him and Carlisle.
Daddies.
Baddie daddies.
And Edward.
No.
No, I'm sorry. He's in timeout right now, especially.
You're fighting that battle on your own.
Yeah.
Can we leave him in timeout for this one and then we'll bring him back in Eclipse?
When he's totally cool with being cocked, yeah, we can bring him back.
Okay, perfect. Okay, beautiful.
He's in timeout for New Moon, 100%. He was unacceptable behavior. I'm sorry.
I can leave him in timeout for New Moon, 100%, because, like, I don't know. Even when he goes on that whole, like, spiel about how, like, it was dark, but there were stars, and then she was, like, the meteor, and then after she left, he couldn't see. I was like,
shut the fuck up.
Stephanie Meyer just took the star-crossed lovers take their life quote from Romeo and Juliet and took it like way too far.
Too much. It was too much. Like,
well, when you're stealing material from other authors, stealing. And books,
let's tamper it down.
When you're taking,
this is not Cassandra Clare. Heavy, we can calm down.
Oh my god, true. I don't know why I got them confused. Cassandra Clare.
Are you talking about Harry Potter fan fiction?
Yes.
Hermione. But anyways, like, even the fact that they had to be young star-crossed lovers. Well, physically young star-crossed lover, because Edward was like, yeah, we can at least delay until you're 30, and then she acted like that was the end of the world, and 30-year-old me is like, ouch, but okay.
Same. She literally says, horror washed over me. I was like, excuse me.
Has the horror washed over us yet?
No.
We're about to find out.
I still have time.
I know, you're the baby.
Oh my god, I am. I love it.
You are.
Privilege. I'm Bella in this situation.
I think Jacob's the baby.
Jacob is the baby. True. He's 16.
Actually, technically, Seth is the baby.
He's not in this book. Well, he is.
He is, for like a second. Oh, I was so surprised that Leah and Seth were mentioned in this.
Okay, Leah was apparently exotic beauty. And I just put my head in my hands. Oh, like, God. She's the opposite of exotic. But sure.
So at what point does Sam have his transformation in terms of the way that the books go? Because isn't Leah's like super happy or enthusiastically on the phone with someone with the way that it's described? Because I know she's like,
it can't be Sam because Sam's with Emily at that point.
He's already like messed up her face. Yeah,
exactly. Which is why I'm like, I'm just trying to figure out when that would have happened. She's not that much younger than Jacob. Doesn't her transformation...
Isn't she older?
Yeah, I think so, actually. She's supposed to be...
They transform after the horror that is losing their father, the Clearwaters. That's what happens.
Oh, right. Okay, cool.
Both Seth and Leah, yeah. They transform after losing their father.
That's fair. I did not remember that part.
I don't know who she was on the phone with.
Not Sam.
No.
That whole story, I guess, of like the reason that they transform in and of itself is kind of sad as well.
Yeah, they only transform because there are vampires near them, which is why they had that whole treaty in the first place. So the Cullens leaving kind of fucked that up for them.
Yeah.
Because Victoria was just back in their land. So it just kept causing more and more transformations over time. That's so brutal.
Although I do have to say, this is going back a bit. If I was Bella standing in that meadow with Laurent and then all of a sudden all these gigantic bear wolf looking things came up, this girl should be a lot more traumatized than she is sometimes, I swear to God.
Yeah, she was. I feel like she just does not realize it half the time.
Yeah.
That is also my major gripe with this book as well, because the whole thing between between Alice and the werewolves is she can't see the werewolves intervening, so like she couldn't see Jacob saving her when she jumped off the cliff. She should have seen Bella fucking dying from Laurent in that instance.
Agreed.
That's major big fucking plot hole. Hello? Like what? That should have been when the Cullens hypothetically, or Alice at least, came back, because she would be dead if it were not for the intervention of the werewolves. So why not Laurent and why the cliff diving? It makes no sense.
I mean, maybe it's because she wasn't actively looking for her future anymore.
No, but
again,
she wasn't with Bella.
She mentions she still gets them because they're tied or connected now. So yeah, no, that does not make any sense.
I'm wondering if it's one of those things where because she wasn't quote unquote looking out for her, the only reason she got the cliff diving one was because Bella literally nearly died. That's the only explanation I can think of.
The closest and even that, to death?
Yeah. Like that's a loose, very much stretching. But that's the only thing I could think of.
We're suspending our belief.
That is stretching.
Or the logic.
She's like she's literally one step behind from Laurent just killing her. It's
agreed.
She's in the same position in terms of death, whether she's drowning or one step away from a vampire that is really hungry and would like to eat her. So
yeah,
it doesn't feel that different. Yes, it was more self-initiated, but in terms of her death, that was just very much a thing that was going to happen right there and then. So I don't get it.
For the plot.
Exactly. Literally.
Also, another thing I guess I didn't realize is the "Where have you been, Loca?" The most iconic, I feel like, line of the movie, Taylor Lautner's favorite line, does not exist in the book.
Nope.
I completely forgot. Instead, he calls her honey.
Ugh. He calls her honey a lot, though.
He does. Maybe this is also why I didn't like him when I was a teenager, but I have always hated pet names. So I feel like every time he called her honey, I was like, God, please no, stop. Like, I like you. You're so sweet. Please stop.
I don't hate pet names. It just doesn't make sense for a 16-year-old to be throwing around honey.
I mean, at that point, he's supposed to look older than a 16-year-old.
Mentally, he's still a 16-year-old. He's not 110 cosplaying 17.
Stop.
Aren't there metaphorical ages like 40 and like 35 or something like that, or 35 and 32, when they do that cute little like math thing based on their skills?
Yeah, where he's trying to tell Bella that he's not too young to be in a relationship with her, basically. Yes, that. Yeah. He's 6'5 and 16. That's fucking insane to me. And then he gets taller, apparently, because he's a werewolf.
So he's a tree.
He's literally he should be in the NBA. Where is this man's contract? Get him out there. Or in tennis, something, anything.
Some kind of sport so that he can buy himself some new shoes, because they make that comment about how Billy can't afford to buy him any more shoes because he keeps phasing and ripping his shoes.
Even at the end, she's like, I think when after they have the final show, oh, he drops off the bike in front of their house. Yeah, that was not a good move at all by him. But like at the end, after that whole entire encounter between Bella, Edward, and Jacob, he has like a shred of a shoe left behind.
That was also another example of miscommunication or misunderstanding, because he thought that she wasn't visiting because Edward wasn't letting her, when the reality was that she was grounded.
Yeah. And he felt bad. He felt really bad about it.
Same thing with Alice, like Alice showing up and Edward trying to kill himself. These are all examples of
fucking Rosalie
miscommunication.
Rosalie, misunderstanding. Why would you do this? And then Rosalie apologizes. But at the same time, it's just like, why?
Because they want to make her the villain so badly.
Again,
listen, I'm a Rosalie apologist.
She makes her own villainous actions by the end of the book. So that's by the end of the series, like she's a fucking, anyways, a creep.
Yeah.
Just as bad as Jacob in a way.
I did feel a type of way for her in Eclipse, but we'll get to that eventually.
We'll get to that next year. I feel all kinds of ways for her, but sometimes the ways are not good. Like, why? Anyways.
Speaking of the rest of the Cullens, I saw this thing online that was basically like, we need to forgive Jasper for attacking Bella because he's attuned to other people's emotions. So he would be able to be attuned to Edward's thirst for Bella. And I was like, people are stretching this too far, I think.
No, that's a mistake because... Okay,
we need to stop seeing. I don't think thirst is the pre-sons.
Yeah,
because even when Arrow reads Edward's thoughts, because he can do that by touching somebody's hand, he cannot read Bella's thoughts because she's apparently immune to everyone, including Jane. He says like he doesn't understand how Edward can be so close to her because of how she smells, and then that seems almost to be like a non-issue by the end of it, because he's like, I thought you were dead, so at this point the thirst doesn't matter. And I was like, if it was that easy this whole time, then...
Bella, why don't you kill yourself soon?
Honestly.
Stop.
But no, 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 no.
Not actually, but also, how is this a solution? How does this make sense?
It's just like, you have enough mental strength to overcome your physical body's thirst, like your innate nature, but you don't have enough mental strength to think, maybe I should talk to my girlfriend about the danger that she's in instead of just fucking picking up and leaving her. Make it make sense.
With more danger than you previously had, because now you're almost defenseless. With the exception of the werewolves, she did not know existed until the point that Jacob conveniently turned into a werewolf. That everyone conveniently also tried to hide from her. And she literally lived in this land of, oh my god, I'm gonna die and Charlie's gonna die for like weeks.
That was, I guess, like the one part where Jacob was kind of a little bit cruel, but I also kind of like understand why. She compares it to like an infection in a sore. And that was kind of shitty, but I can forgive him. He undergone something completely life-altering. He's also a teenage boy.
Him calling and like basically almost crying to Bella saying like he's in so much pain right now. He's never been in so much pain before. I was just like, that's so sad. He's like 16 undergoing.
He's just a kid.
Yeah, literally. And this is happening because
of the fucking Cullens.
Like had they not left, technically, Edward and Bella would be together forever, but Jacob would at least possibly might have gotten away with it.
Yeah, because one would hope that they would not have been completely incompetent and would have been able to wipe out Victoria earlier.
Without having to go to
Brazil and think that he's tracking her, even though she's literally in Fork. I was like, really, dude? You thought she was in Brazil? Like, seriously? She's in your backyard.
Shut up.
I'm really bad at tracking Bella. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like, no shit.
She's in your backyard. Get the fuck out, Vanessa. Why?
She literally was, though. She's like, you'd have been like, she's outside of your door, Edward. She's right there. I thought she was in Rio.
She's knocking.
Even that scene in the movie where he's standing there in front of, like, is it Jesus, that statue? I think
Rio
Jesus,
de Janeiro,
right?
the statue, yes.
Yes, and he crumples the phone. I'm like, this is the most dramatic. I can't. I mean, I know Edward's dramatic. That's like part of the, I guess, like appeal, because he's also dramatic in like how he's supposed to care about her, apparently, but not in this book.
Not in this book. Correct. It's true.
She's
not wrong.
The most romantic he gets is at the very end when he proposes. And even that, she's just like, is this a joke? Are you for real, sir?
It wasn't even the joke part. She was just like, I'm not interested in this. And he's like, please marry me. Please, 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 please. Let me find it.
Yes, please look. Because, yeah, he proposes, but he's like bartering with her. he's like, I'll change you.
Which is not how a proposal should go. You should not be bartering with the person you proposed.
Agree. He's like, I'll change you, but if you marry me. I feel like if that were me, I would have been like, hi, Alice, I'll take one turning, please. Like,
Carlisle?
I'm not being manipulated into this. And then he can just sit there and be sad that he wasn't the one to do it.
She literally says, oh, come on. I'm only 18. I'm only 18.
So now she thinks she's too young.
To be married, yes.
But not for immortality.
Those are two separate commitments. Committing to yourself is one thing. Committing to another person, totally other thing. You're not tying yourself down to another person. You're tying yourself down to yourself. She could technically break up with Edward and still be a vampire. The marriage thing is a totally separate agreement.
Very true.
But then, like, he brings up his age in the next sentence. He says, well, I'm nearly 110. It's time I settled down. That's not making this conversation any better. In fact, it has made it worse.
It's not about you, Edward. This is supposed to be about her and what she wants.
Consenting to it about a marriage. You.
This entire book has been about him robbing her of choice, so I'm not surprised.
I don't know if he's robbing her, but he's like making it for her because he thinks that she knows better. And then at the end, he was like, it's almost like regretfully realizing that like he didn't know better.
So he stole the choice.
Yeah, I'm like, that's still not letting her have a choice.
That's robbing. He didn't.
It's taken.
He didn't think her capable of making her own decisions, and that's frankly insulting.
That's true.
Vanessa just doesn't like to hear us talk shit about Edward. I'm sorry, Vanessa.
His proposal is really shitty. You should not be bartering and saying, I'm 110. We should settle down with this 18-year-old.
He didn't even have a ring pop.
Stop.
To at least sweeten the deal.
He finds a sparkly ring pop afterwards. Most disgusting ring pop ever.
Oh, ugly.
I guess like we talked about briefly about how like the marketing of the movie seemed to make you want to cheer for either one in the love triangle. And in the end, do you feel like the book gave you that same feeling? Because personally, I don't think it did. I feel like it made me want to be like, if there was a team, it would be like Team Bella. Because at the end, I feel like she doesn't really want Jacob. And at this point, Edward's just been, to bring back our comment from our last bonus episode where we called Snow a bag of dicks. Edward in this book was very much a bag of dicks. What team would, I guess, like everyone think they fell under?
Team Emmett.
He wasn't, okay.
He was barely in this. He installed the stereo in her car, and that was about it.
Could you imagine how happy he was? That grin on his face the moment she opens up an empty box, and he gets to explain what he did? My man.
He didn't even explain it. Somebody else explained it. He was installing it.
Oh, right. Fuck. Still.
Someone watched
the movie.
Sorry,
I confused the movie. But still, imagine his joy. I'm still Team Emmett over anyone. Or Carlisle.
Controversially, I think I'm way more Team Jacob than I've ever been in terms of reading the novel. I don't think she wants a romantic relationship, but I still think somehow the friendship that they contained was way more healthy than what she currently has with Edward in the novel. But I mean, always Team Bella. But I'm also Team Bella seeking therapy, mostly. That's my team. Team Bella seeking therapy, but that does not happen. So here we are.
I do wonder if, like, part of her ability to respond to these traumatic situations is supposed to be, like, again, this could be a stretch, but supposed to be, like, foreshadowing her shield capabilities that she has when she's, yeah.
Oh, so your trauma is your power. Got it.
Unfortunately. Cool. I feel like that may be what she's... I don't like it either, but that's the only thing I can think of as to how she's able to so quickly bounce back from these, like, deeply traumatic situations. And speaking of bouncing back, do we want to rate?
Yeah, I guess so. Who would like to go first?
Not it.
I can go first, since I feel like I had to go first last time, too. I remember I gave Twilight a 5 stars because of the nostalgia. I did. I gave Twilight 5.
I don't know why I wiped this from my memory.
Same.
I feel like part of me wants to give New Moon a 5 as well for the nostalgia. So I'm really tempted to do that. But the other part of me is also tempted to give it a 4 just because I feel like Edward was such a bag of dicks. I think I'll go with the 5 for the nostalgia.
Oh,
now
wow.
I'm ready to hear both of your scathing reviews. Let's go.
I'm gonna give it a solid 3 just because it was a hot mess, not in a good way. I'm gonna give it the potential 4 stars went to a 3 based off of the treatment of Jacob throughout this entire fucking book for no fucking reason, which will change by book three, we know this, but it's definitely in the three area for me personally.
I'll be honest, if it wasn't for the nostalgia, I'd probably give it a 3, but I'm gonna stick with a 5 for the nostalgia.
You can,
but like,
enjoy that. Have a
yeah,
good time.
I will. Yeah. Thank you.
Nav? Don't tell me you're
let's hear the two.
Worse than one.
It's a 2. That's the only reason I'm not giving it a 1, because Red X was like, that was a 1.
It was
me.
Just as bad as Things We Do in the Dark.
I feel like Things We Do in the Dark felt more exciting because I didn't. What? Well, I knew what was going to happen. I wasn't rereading it. I think the disappointment for me was the fact that it did not live up to my nostalgia at all. I felt so let down on this reread. Bella was funny. I think that's the only reason it's not a 1. She's sarcastic. Her inner monologue is great, but I just could not stand the story at all.
Yeah, as a final side note, I feel like Casey did not do Bella's internal monologue justice at all, but yeah, understandable.
No, she really didn't. Like, it was no.
Any emotions she had were lost.
Which is really funny because K-Stu can be really, she's a great comedic actress.
It was too heteronormative. Like,
yeah.
You know, exactly. You know why. Okay, we can move on.
Oh my God.
But no, it's a 2. The only reason I can't give it a 1 is because I can't justify it being as bad as Red X.
Damn.
Brutal.
I would have definitely never rated it a 2 just low. Because I'm thinking about the 2s that we read this year. Damn.
No, I think I went into it and I did it to my own self. I was expecting too much. I've like, honestly,
you need to put your bar on the floor along with Bella's expectations.
Yeah. I feel like I need to bury it 6 feet under because it's not like I haven't reread all of these nostalgic books that, you know, we read when we were in high school. I have reread City of Bones over the years ever so often whenever I don't want to read anything. There's something there. That book can still elicit not the same feelings I had as a reader when I was 16 or whatever, whenever it came out, but I still am like looking forward to certain scenes. With this one, maybe it's just because the tone of New Moon is so depressing. I just at no point was excited about anything happening. I was just like, this is really depressing for Bella the entire time. Even for Edward, like, it wasn't like I wasn't Team Edward or Team Jacob. I was definitely Team Edward. I had those t-shirts. I wore it to my sweet 16. I hated him.
So you basically, Edward's, like, your perception of Edward made you rate this a 2. Because he was such a shit. Okay, got it. So it's Edward's fault. Got it.
Yeah. Like, I hated him. Jacob was a sweetheart. He's a 16-year-old boy. Acting like a 16-year-old boy. His reactions, all of those are valid. Even the motorcycle at the end, I get. When you're 16, you're gonna make emotionally based decisions that may not always pay off in the way that you want. And this was because of miscommunication. It made sense. With Edward, you're 110 cosplaying 17. How are you not getting it, buddy? Where is the disconnect?
In his brain?
I couldn't. I'm sorry, Vanessa. Your book boyfriend is gross.
Okay. Well, on that though,
I'm so sorry, Vanessa.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
The silence is just deafening.
Yeah. She's crying. It's fine. Before we wrap things up, we want to thank everyone for listening and leaving us their lovely ratings. Hopefully you enjoyed reading New Moon as much as we did. So now comes the part where we spin from the Wheel of Doom. Just as a refresher, the whole premise of our show is based on 6 books that are randomly pulled from a list we've all contributed to. First is the list of good books, so books we've heard good things about or just generally wanted to read. And then there's the forbidden selection of bad books. That list generally consists of what we consider poorly written erotica or books that would generally torture us mentally. Now, we've randomly pulled 5 books out of the good list and 1 book out of the bad list prior to the show.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now, so you left.
I did. I died. I blipped. I was trying to respond to you, Nav. I was saying, that's no problem. That's okay. You can hate on my book boyfriend. He deserves it. I'm over here yelling into my mic, and I was like, why is nobody paying attention to what I'm saying? I'm like, I'm all alone.
Just like Edward and love Bella.
Oh, wow.
Honestly. You're just going to jump off a cliff.
Same.
Oh, my God.
Relatable content. Okay. Now we randomly pull 5. Okay. Now we randomly pull 5 books out of the good list and 1 book out of the bad list prior to the show. That bad book is The Bullet in the Chamber, and here we have our Russian roulette, so to speak. Now we shall begin. So first of the good books is My Sister the Serial Killer by Oyinkin Breathwaite, suggested by Vanessa. Tender is the Flesh by Augustina Basterica, and that was suggested by Rebecca. On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong, and that was suggested by Rebecca. The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue by V.E. Schwab, and that was suggested by Vanessa. And The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, and that was suggested by Nav. And the bad book is 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James, suggested by Nav.
I'm not reading any more thrillers for the next few months. I know the last one was my fault.
Oh, no. Vanessa, these were all your faults.
The Burning only Girls that was my fault was...
Listen, Burning Girls was a mistake.
Burning that Girls, spoiler alert, mistake. Guest list, bad.
Red X, I feel, clears my sins.
No.
The fair. Sins are cumulative.
Fair.
This is not the Catholic Church, okay?
You mean I can't pay indulgences and clean my slate?
No.
Fair.
No.
To hell you go, the rest of us.
Wee.
So now let me spin. Okay. This is going to be really depressing, January. So the poll was On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. It's another me pick.
Ooh, I'm excited for that one. I've heard really good things.
Me too. I'm very excited.
Same. Okay. So don't forget, we will be seeing you again at the end of the month with Winter in Sochko by Elisa Shua Dusapan. Thank you to me for that pick. And we'll see everyone again in January with On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. Have a good one, folks. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed spending some time with us. As a reminder, we post our podcast on the 15th of every month. If you want to read along and have the financial means to, please try to support your local bookstores. But we don't judge. If reading isn't your thing, or you just don't have the time, audiobooks are just as great. If you like what you're hearing, please drop us a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. You can also find us on Twitter, TikTok, Goodreads, and Instagram at Revolver Reads. If you have any book suggestions of your own or reviews for the books we read, please feel free to send us an email at revolverreads@gmail.com. If you're submitting a suggestion, please don't forget to let us know if it's a neutral or a good book or a quote-unquote bad book, in your opinion. Have a good one, folks.